From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the pathological liar, annoying man, master thespian, and Harry Hanukkah. We meet comic John Lovitz. The former cast member of Saturday Night Live has his own live special coming up on Fox. Also, a talk about solitude with writer Sue Halpern. Her new book examines its many forms. And commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews The City of Quartz, the new book about L.A. by urban theorist Mike Davis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State James Baker said today that the Mideast peace process was alive and well as Palestinian and Israeli negotiators met in Washington for a second day of talks. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Israeli and Palestinian negotiators tried to hammer out an agreement on elections for the occupied territories at talks today at the State Department. The Israelis have proposed so-called pilot elections in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, which would give 1.7 million Palestinians the right to vote for municipal leaders for the first time since 1976. Israeli spokesman, Deputy Foreign Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, was upbeat, saying there had been progress in today's talks. Meanwhile, Palestinian spokeswoman Hanan Ashrawi was decidedly downbeat in her assessment of the talks, arguing that her delegation had made several objections to the Israeli proposals. She insisted that Palestinians be given the right to govern their own affairs before any municipal elections are held. The current round of peace talks is expected to continue through Thursday. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
The State Farm insurance companies agreed today to the largest damage settlement ever in a U.S. sex discrimination case. Lawyers in the class action suit said that more than 800 women will share in a settlement worth at least $157 million. The lead attorney in the 13-year-old case, Guy Saperstein, said that the award is already the largest ever under the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and it could eventually reach $205 million. A spokesman for the State Farm company said that the firm decided to settle the claims to avoid further litigation and legal costs. The women who filed the suit claimed that they were denied sales jobs. A day after a former aide to German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher was nominated to replace him, the decision was overturned by angry party members. They instead nominated popular Justice Minister Klaus Kinkel. Deirdre Berger reports from Cologne.
After the unexpected resignation yesterday of German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher, leaders of his Free Liberal Party nominated as his replacement Building Minister Irmgard Schwetzer, a former state secretary in the foreign ministry. She would have been the first female foreign minister in Bonn. But Free Liberal parliamentarians revolted against the snap decision of the party leadership. At a turbulent meeting this evening, they nominated instead Justice Minister Klaus Kinkel, a former intelligence chief who has gained respect in his 18-month stint in the Bonn cabinet. Meanwhile, widespread strikes continue to paralyze public transportation and other services in Germany today. For the second day running, there were massive traffic jams in most cities, and tens of thousands came late to work. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Cologne.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 3 points to close at 3,308. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. 78 demonstrators were arrested today in Buffalo, New York, after anti-abortion protesters tried to charge a clinic where abortions are performed. Buffalo police said they arrested 73 of the abortion opponents and 5 abortion rights activists. The director of the clinic said it remained open and that women were getting in to have abortions. The Pentagon has issued a statement describing the incident last Friday when Peruvian Air Force jets opened fire on an American plane returning from an anti-drug mission. One American was killed, 4 others injured. We have a report from NPR's Neil Conan.
The Pentagon statement said that an Air Force C-130 transport plane was on a mission pre-approved by the Peruvian government. It broke off that mission after it was approached by a Peruvian plane and it headed out to sea to reach international airspace. Though Peru claims sovereignty 200 miles beyond its coast, most other countries, including the U.S., only recognize a 12-mile limit. After the C-130 was 80 miles offshore, it was approached by two Soviet-made fighters. While the Americans tried to establish radio contact, the Peruvians waggled their wings and later fired what may have been warning shots, though no tracer rounds were seen. Then the U.S. plane was strafed by cannon fire. Decompression blew out a window and a crew member was sucked out of the plane. As the C-130 turned toward the Peruvian coast and descended, it was strafed twice more, injuring four crew members. The incident occurred in daylight with unlimited visibility, and the statement said the U.S. plane was clearly marked. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
The Air Force said today that its only functional test model of the planned new F-22 stealth fighter crashed and burned at Edwards Air Force Base in California on Saturday. An Air Force spokeswoman said the test plane hit the runway before its landing gear could be lowered. The Lockheed test pilot escaped with minor injuries. Lockheed's chairman said the crash was not a setback to the company's $60 billion program to develop the radar-evading jet. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Lovitz, is about to do a live TV show, but it's not Saturday Night Live, where he got his start. He'll host and star in a one-hour comic play live from the Aquarius Theater in Los Angeles. You can see it May 17th on Fox right after Married with Children. Lovitz was a cast member of Saturday Night Live from 1984 to 1990. He became best known for the characters he created, like Tommy Flanagan, the pathological liar, the pretentious actor known as Master Thespian, Annoying Man, and a caricature of gay writer and actor Harvey Fierstein. Lovitz is happy to get another shot at live TV.
Well, I'm excited about it. I did Saturday Night Live for 5 years, and, you know, there's nothing more exciting than live television. I mean, unless you've done it, you don't know, but it's tremendously thrilling. And I didn't want to do a regular sitcom. I'd done one before, and it was, you know, I enjoyed doing it, but after doing Saturday Night Live, to go back to that format for me was, frankly, too boring. Also, because when you're doing a sitcom, you tape for 2 hours, and a lot of times you're redoing scenes, and you're asking the audience to laugh again, and you have a warm-up person that talks incessantly between every scene. And and then even after that, you have another 3 hours or more of doing pickup shots after the audience has left. And I didn't want to do that. Also, another reason we're live is so that we can focus on the acting and the writing, as opposed to, say, special effects or a lot of camera cuts.
In the years that you were live on Saturday Night Live, were there times when being live turned into a nightmare, when something went terribly wrong and it was kind of embarrassing?
No, nothing like that. I mean, nothing ever went terribly wrong. I mean, there was a couple of times when I just wanted to bolt off stage.
Would you name one?
Well, I don't know. One time I was doing something on Update, and it wasn't going that well, and I just wanted to run away. But you couldn't, because the camera's just, all of a sudden you just become really aware. It's like a silent eye just staring at you and knowing that everyone's looking at you. The one time it really hit me was my first show when the first thing I ever did on the show, it was a panel discussion. So when the camera came to me, I just remember thinking, God, the whole country's looking at me right now. We're live. And then I thought, oh, no, it's 3 hours later in California. So, all right, that's like 10 million less.
That was reassuring.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Lovitz, and he has a special that will be on Fox TV on May 17th. I'd like to ask you about some of the characters that you created for Saturday Night Live.
Oh, okay.
Why don't we start with Tommy Flanagan, the pathological liar, which is the character that you first really became famous for from the show. How did you create him?
Well, I got it from old movies when, you know, in the 40s, and I'd say, yeah, that's the ticket. And yeah, I mean, I didn't make up that phrase. And then it really started as an inside joke between a friend of mine and I, and a girl, and I was always trying to pick up on her, and she said she liked the guy with the fat wallet. So I'd say, well, you know, my dad just had 15 oil wells come in, and she'd say, yeah, right. And I'd say, well, I am a pathological liar. And then I was in the Growlings Theater, and I decided to write it up as a monologue, as a like a person at Alcoholics Anonymous when they get up and say, you know, I'm an alcoholic and here's my story. And I, not that that's funny, but I thought it would be funny if it was a guy like Pathological Liars Anonymous. And then the guy would get up and start telling how he lied and then just start lying about that. And the first time I did it, you know, I did it and people laughed. And then this engineer that worked at NBC came up to Lauren's office and said, oh, that's the funniest thing I ever saw. You should put that on more. And so it's because of the audience response, really, that you repeat characters. You know, it's not the other way around. It's the audience picks the hit characters, and then, you know, so you continue to do them.
But at a certain point, you gave up the character. What was that point?
Well, I'd done it so many times, and I just wanted to move on.
Mm-hmm.
After the second year, it was just kind of enough.
So you decided to stop it?
Yeah, people are, you know, on Saturday Night Live, they're kind of weird about that. When you have a hit character,
they want you to milk it?
Well, no, they want you to do it, and when it becomes popular, then everyone tends to, you know, because they're comedians, they tend to make fun of it and not really, you know, go, yeah, that. And it's a weird thing when you have a hit character, they're not saying, hey, that's great. They're kind of saying, like, making fun of it, because the show, I guess, is supposed to be like anti-culture, you know, or whatever, you know, against the establishment. So when you have a hit character and it becomes part of that, then they end up, you know, making fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
So then after, you know, it bothered me at first, and then after a while I go, okay, I get it, you know. But I kind of got tired of doing it, and then it made me feel good when I did Annoying Man my last year, and I just slapped it together and, like, you know, I just said, give me the costume, and I wrote it in like 30 seconds.
You want to describe the character?
I just trying to be somebody who's annoying in every possible way, and a very grating voice, and, you know, like, hello, how are you? You know, and if you listen to someone talk like that for a long time, it would start getting annoying, and then I would chew on tin foil and take a fork and, you know, scrape it against a pan, and, you know, really grating a chalkboard, you know, it was really grating. And it was just very silly. And in my opinion, it was very stupid. It was just being very silly. And it was taking a character like that, and then, which was completely non-cerebral, just, you know, ridiculously silly and dumb. And then, it became popular, and it felt good to me, because a lot of the writers are from Harvard, and they're like, oh, you know, they're trying to write really sophisticated, clever stuff that doesn't work a lot of times. And then you just come along with something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, you know, ha, ha, ha.
So let me ask you about Master Thespian, your most pretentious actor. What was the story behind the creation of that character?
Oh, well, I went to a college at UC Irvine, and there was a professor of mine, William Needles, who taught me Shakespeare. And when he would do it, though, himself, he'd always go, he'd say, like, the opening speech from Henry V, the chorus, and was, oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. And he would say, like, oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. Like that. And I thought it was very funny. I thought it was very good, but very funny, too. And I used to imitate him. And then I kind of put it together with, you know, and then I wanted to be an actor. And an actor is a, you know, that's what a thespian is. So I was like the master thespian. You know, I was just joking around with my friend and say, I'm the master thespian. Because I just wanted to be a great actor. That was my goal.
John Lovitz is my guest. So how did you come up with the Harvey Fierstein character for the I Just Want to Be Loved? Is that so wrong?
Oh, well, I'd seen him in a play before. You know, he has a very distinctive style and voice. And then I was watching some show. He did Tidy Endings. And then I was reading in the paper about him. He had this movie, Torch Song Trilogy, coming out. So I was reading about him, and I just found I could imitate him really easily, and so I just came up with it. And in the I Just Want to Be Loved, Is That So Wrong? In this article, it said he's been celibate for a year and a half, you know, and he's gay, and that's pretty much what his, I guess, work is about in his life. So he said he's been celibate for a year and a half, and he said, I just want a man to wrap his arms around me and hold me, is that so wrong? So I just made it, and I Just Want to Be Loved, Is That So Wrong? And, you know, I just painted a picture of somebody who was looking for somebody. And anyway, I did it, and he didn't like it. And I finally did the third time I did it with Kathleen Turner, was on the show, and I wrote a thing where, you know, she tries to pick up on me and kisses me, and I faint. I go, never happened. And then the next guest is Lee Iacocca, and I end up with him. I mean, the sketch is pretty silly, but he didn't like it, and it was in the papers. He's complained about it in Arsenio Hall, and he came to the show and said why he didn't like it and felt I was doing a stereotype of gay people, and then he was nice about it, and I didn't, you know.
It must be hard when you're doing somebody who's based on an actual person as opposed to a type. You know, like Master Thespian is a type of
Yeah,
person.
Well, everyone said, oh, you should have changed the name. You know, like they did Hans and Franz, and it's really they're imitating Arnold Schwarzenegger, but they just make it, you know, they changed it and mm-hmm. said, we'll make it his cousins, and who idolize him, which adds to the sketch. I don't know. I didn't really ever think it would be a problem. And there was people on the show who are gay. I said, is this offending you? And they all said no. And one guy said, no, it isn't. But if it was, you know, I would tell you. And, you know, this is a makeup man who had, you know, been in the show by then like 4 or 5 years, I knew.
Yeah. One of my favorite sketches of the ones that you've done on Saturday Night Live was Harry Hanukkah.
Oh.
Did you write that?
No. Al Franken and Mike Myers wrote it.
Oh.
But I based it on, they wrote it and it was really funny. And then I based it on this actor, Ned Glass. He talks like this. And he was the father on Bridget and Bernie. He was the Jewish father. He was in, he's probably best in the West Side Story. He was Pops, who I guess who runs the drugstore, the candy store.
Mm-hmm.
And, when I was 15 years old...
What's wrong with you kids?
Well, when I was... You know, if you see these movies, you know who he is. When I was 15 years old, I was at my best friend's house, and his father is a doctor, and Ned Glass was one of his patients. And I was 15, and my friend's father says to Ned Glass, John wants to be an actor. And he says, you want to be an actor? He goes, what would you do if you hurt your toe? And I said, I'd say, ouch. He goes, would you say ouch if you were Hercules? And he goes, you know what you have to do? Because you know what you have to know to be an actor? You have to know everything. You think you could know everything? You have to know everything. You know, so as if he knew everything. And then he goes, you know, there was only... he was the same in everything he played. And he was, you know, he was a good actor and he was funny, but he was just himself. He was exactly the same. And he says, you know... There was only two actors who were never typecast, me and Paul Muni. Anyways, I never forgot him, he was good. He was a funny actor, you know, he's funny, but, you know, he never, I guess he always thought he played all these different characters, and really he was just always, hello, how are you? I mean, in Julius Caesar, in the movie with Marlon Brando, he's in the opening market scene, and everyone's going, my lord, come here and hither. And he's in the market saying, you want to buy some oranges, my lord? You know.
My guest is John Lovitz. He's a former cast member of Saturday Night Live. He'll host and star in a live comic theater special on Fox TV May 17th. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. John Lovitz is my guest. Were there any jokers in your family? Did you have a father who'd sit around the dinner table and tell jokes?
Yeah, he used to goof off, and he used to make prank phone calls. And I mean, the look for annoying man I got from him, he used to comb his hair forward and wear his glasses low. He didn't act like that, but that's where I got the look from. And he used to do something. He used to come home and tell us he was his twin brother, Howard. We would be like 7 or 8, but he would play it so straight for like a half an hour, and just insist on it, and then he would leave, and then like 20 minutes later come back. I guess he would just wait in his car, and then we'd say Howard was here. He goes, he was, you know.
So he really had a twin brother, Howard?
Huh? No, he didn't.
Oh, he didn't.
No, he just said he did.
I see. Okay.
We were young. He would do stuff like that.
Did you ever do stand up?
Well, I'd imitate their albums, you know, and then I went to the comedy store after college once, and they said, well, you know, you have good presence, but, you know, work on it and come back in 3 months. And then I would go to the, at the improv at the time, Robin Williams was on Mark and Mindy, and at the comedy store, and they would have this improv potluck night, where on Mondays anybody could, you could just show up and get up on stage and improvise. So I went, I started going on Mondays, and I went like twice, and then the third Monday I went, I was in line, and I got to the front of the line, and the guy said, was letting people in, said, "Oh, we're asking certain people not to come back, and you're one of them."
Well, that's nice.
Yeah, and I was like pretty crushed, and I wasn't crying, but I was like, you know, like God, you know, it was pretty devastating. So I just said, well, I didn't say forget this place. So, and then but the point is that if I'd been a real stand-up, a real stand-up heart, then I would have just said, well, this guy's an idiot. What does he know?
Mm-hmm.
And kept going. But that was more improv. And then I still tried it, and I went to at the Comedy Store, they had this comedian teaching this workshop on Saturdays that was for free, and you could just go. And so he'd go, and he was, helping, but he'd say, I went once, and he said, well, he goes, they're not hiring stand-ups for comedy. He goes, you think they would, but they go, well, they're stand-ups, they're not actors, which I guess was true partially. So I just thought, well, I'll just skip that step and just be an actor. You know, I thought it would be a way in. And so I never really did it. And since I got started live, I've gotten up on stage, like a Catch Rising Star in the Improv in L.A. about 10 times. But the Comedy Store at the time was a very strange place. It was everybody was very bitter because Herr Robin Williams came and he made it and was famous. And you got the feeling everyone felt they should be, Robin Williams too. So like you'd have the doormen who were comedians working the door, but they were just very bitter and angry. And it was just a very, I didn't like it, it was a very weird place.
Mm-hmm. When you left Saturday Night Live in 1990, what were your reasons for leaving then?
Well, the real reason is my contract was up, and I had a good year, and then I had a chance to do this. All of a sudden, I had gotten three movies in a row, Mr. Destiny and A League of Their Own and Mom and Dad Save the World. And so I was going to be able to... I did Mr. Destiny in April, and then I was going to do those two movies in the summer. And A League of Their Own fell through, and then Mom and Dad Save the World, their schedule changed. And so I would have had to miss two shows in the beginning of the season. And Lorne Michaels said, well, you can't, no, he has a policy, you can't miss shows. And so I had to make a choice between if I was going to do this movie or go back to the show. And I felt that it was a great part, and financially it was paying me the same amount of money. So I felt, well, if I leave the show, I'll be secure financially. And I felt, well, I could do the show another year. And they wanted me to do two more years, which is, like saying, hey, we'll hire you for two more years, which is nice. But I felt that, well, I'd gotten as much out of the show as I could. And after, 2 years, the movies might not be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what to do. And I really had to make a choice. And this is a pretty funny story. I'd been sent a script early in the year. And I'd read it, and they said, well, they really want to meet with you on this movie. And I said, oh, I don't know. And I read it, and I thought, well, this is pretty funny. But the part was more of a, it was just like a smaller part where all I do is react to the situation. And I the lead was this kid. And I said, well, this is the kid's movie. And I go, oh, I don't want to play second fiddle to some kid. And they go, well, they really want to meet with you. And I said, well, I don't know. The movie's funny, and I think it's good, but the part doesn't interest me. Anyway, so the movie was Home Alone.
Oh, gosh.
So, yeah. So then I thought, oops. So when this movie came on, I read it, and I go, well, I don't want to make the same mistake again. But really, you couldn't make the same mistake again. Nobody knows.
Is it difficult to convince casting directors that you can do parts outside of the types of characters you created on Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, it's difficult. One time, I had met Dustin Hoffman before, and he said, you're in my next picture, And I'd met him once. We had the same agency, and then a man about 8 months later, he goes, oh, I didn't know who you were when I met you, and I've seen you, you're very funny, you're in my next movie. And then I ran into him again about a year later in the street, and I said, he goes, hey, how are you? I go, good. I go, well, you said I was in your next movie, and then Rain Man came out, and I said, Tom Cruise, what happened to me? So he laughed, and he goes, well, I met then, I'm bringing you into my next movie, which was Billy Bathgate, and he did bring me in, he was really nice. And he brought me in to meet Robert Benton, and he just said, well, I just think John, Oh, well, what happened was there was on the table, there was the paper, there was two copies of Billy Bathgate, the hardcover and the paperback. So I go in, and I said, Robert Benton, so which movie are you doing, the hardcover or the paperback? and they laughed. And then he said, well, this is a serious movie. And then Dustin Hoffman goes, yeah, now's not the time to be funny. And I went, oh. So anyway, we talked, and I was thrilled that he brought me in. And he's saying, well, you know, where can I just think John's great, and he does the characters. Where can we fit him in the movie? What do you think of this part of it? And Robert Benton said, oh, I know, he can do anything, I'm sure, but I just think the audience will start laughing once they see him on the screen. And I said, well, yeah, they might laugh at first, but then, you know, after a few minutes, then it'll be fine, you know. So it wasn't a question of whether I could had the ability, in Rob Benton's mind, whether I had the ability or to do it or not, but whether, like, you know, they'll see me and start laughing. But I don't know. So I didn't get in the movie, but that's all right. And so I don't know. I'll get the opportunity. You know, I don't know. I don't know. I don't really view it as my problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I if people want to limit, you know, you're on Saturday Night Live and you play, you know, a million, you know, what, five different characters almost every week, you know, for 91 shows, and it's, you know, and then people say, well, can you play this? And you're going, well, I guess I can do these 500, but this is, you know. No, this one style, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Everyone on the on that show, not only saying myself, but Jan Hooks, Dana Carvey, Phil Hartman, you know, they're all tremendously versatile and really can, you know, play any style and any, you know, can do it.
So, one last question. Do you still watch Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, sure.
Do you ever wish you were still on it, or are you sure you made the right choice?
Well, yeah, after I left, I honestly wondered for a long time if I made the right choice or not. But I definitely think I did.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like, you know, and at the time my thinking was the same, was I had a good year. I left going out on top. And I knew that they were going to hire a lot of new people. And they say, no, if you hadn't left, we wouldn't have. But they were hiring. When I was even there, they were going to hire two more people and more. So that's not true. They were going to hire a lot of new people. And a lot of, you know, there's 18 people on the show now, and a lot of, I mean, the own cast that's on the show now, they say it in, there's some article in Us Magazine, they're all, it's very frustrating, you know, you do a show, like Victoria Jackson, she appeared on a show, and then she missed four shows, you know,
mm-hmm.
wasn't on it at all. And I didn't want to, I felt that, for me, that would just be sliding backwards. I didn't want to, you know, go backwards. And so I figured, well, I'd rather be one of three people in a movie than one of, you know, 20. You know, with the host, it's 19. With me there, it'd have been 20, you know, 20.
Right. Do you feel that there aren't that many good movie comedy scripts out there and that TV might be a kind of better place for a while? You know, with your TV special coming up, where you'd have more input in it?
Well, for me personally, yes. I mean, I am not in the position to just say, all right, I want to make this movie, let's make it. I mean, yeah, there aren't that, for me, for my taste, no, there aren't that many funny scripts out there. I mean, but ask any actor, there aren't that many great scripts, period. You know, and every actor's always saying that, and it's true. And, but I like to write stuff and write my own comedy, and so really on this style of comedy and you really can only do on television where you come up with an idea and you work on it and then you can present it, you know, that week. And, you know, movies, it takes forever.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when you're in a film, unless you're the director or you have final cut, you know, you don't have any say over your performance. And so for me, yeah, I think TV is a great place.
Well, John Lovitz, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Lovitz hosts and stars in a live comedy special Sunday, March 17th, right after Married with Children on Fox. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, solitude. For a monk, it means reflection. For a prisoner, it means punishment. We talk with writer Sue Halpern about her new book, Migrations to Solitude, essays about solitude in its many forms. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews The City of Quartz by Mike Davis. It presents an apocalyptic view of L.A. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In meetings on Capitol Hill and at the White House, Russia's chief economist, Yegor Gaidar, called on the West to move ahead with its promised aid. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
President Bush assured Gaidar Congress will eventually approve his aid package, which includes $4 billion in loans and outright grants, plus another $12 billion for the International Monetary Fund. The IMF needs the money to help the former Soviet republics, provided they meet tough requirements. While all was going smoothly in Washington, there were signs of trouble in Moscow. President Yeltsin said Russia does not intend to work under the direct orders of the IMF. Gaidar played this down. Yeltsin, he explained, was merely trying to assure the Russian public, the country's future wasn't being dictated by the West. Asked if his reform program and that of the IMF were basically the same, Gaidar said yes. President Bush has recently encouraged American businesses to invest in Russia, but privately, U.S. officials told Gaidar red tape, legal chaos, and new taxes were serious obstacles. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
According to a U.N. spokesman, tent camps are planned for the hundreds of thousands of people who have fled the current fighting in Bosnia, most of them moving on to Croatia. In Bosnia, various factions continue to battle, while members of the European community try to hold peace talks in Lisbon. The fighting started after Muslims and Croatians in Bosnia voted for independence earlier this year and intensified after the state won broad international backing this month. Serbian groups make up about one-third of Bosnia's population and oppose independence. In California, a jury continues for a six-day its deliberations in the trial of four Los Angeles policemen charged with beating motorist Rodney King. Adrian Chufo reports from Simi Valley.
Today, one of the four defendants gave an impromptu press conference outside the courthouse. Officer Lawrence Powell, who is seen on the videotape delivering the most blows, said he was apprehensive but trying to remain optimistic about his chances for acquittal. Asked his thoughts about the man he beat, Rodney King, Powell said,
"He's no victim. He's just a civil attorney's client and a political puppet. It's the best way to describe it."
Is King being used as well, you feel?
Oh, sure he is.
For what end?
I don't know. Political ends, I'm sure.
The African-American community in Los Angeles has a keen interest in the impending verdict. Clergymen have called for calm, even in the event of acquittal. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Police Department has set aside $1 million in police overtime to keep the peace following the verdict. For National Public Radio, I'm Adrian Chufo in Simi Valley, California.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 3 points to close at 3,307.92. This is NPR News. The American Red Cross says it's in serious financial trouble because of a high number of natural disasters. Officials of the agency want $30 million to help it deal with its financial problems. 2 years ago, the American Red Cross spent a record $224 million in connection with Hurricane Hugo and a San Francisco earthquake. Last year, it spent $184 million. The National Marine Fisheries Service is planning to strengthen regulations designed to keep endangered sea turtles out of the nets of shrimp fishermen working along the eastern seaboard in the Gulf of Mexico. NPR's John Nielsen reports.
2.5 years ago, when coastal shrimpers were first ordered to install what are known as turtle excluder devices for several months every year, spokesmen for the industry predicted economic havoc. They also railed against the Federal Endangered Species Act, which protects the turtles. But the shrimp catch has actually risen since the regulations were imposed. Meanwhile, some of the threatened turtles have shown signs of recovery. To make sure that the recovery continues, the Fisheries Service now wants shrimpers working in lagoons and bays to start using the devices. It also wants them used year-round. Environmental groups say the new plan will help save the leatherneck, the Kemp's Ridley, the loggerhead, the hawksbill, and green turtles from extinction. Shrimpers are expected to renew their objections during a 90-day public comment period. Turtle excluder devices are metal grills or special nets that deflect turtles out of shrimp nets. In Washington, I'm John Nielsen.
According to various U.S. military officials, a test model of the new Air Force stealth fighter was badly damaged after a crash landing over the weekend. The airplane was the only flyable model of the new fighter, and it caught fire after it landed at Edwards Air Force Base in California. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Being alone can offer a much-needed time for reflection, or it can be hell. It can be something you desire, or something you're forced to endure. My guest Sue Halpern has written a new collection of essays called Migrations to Solitude. She writes about solitude in its many forms, from hermits who've chosen to live deep in the woods, to monks who've taken vows of silence, and prisoners serving time in solitary confinement. And she writes about why she and her husband moved from New York City to a small town in New York's Adirondack Mountains. One essay is about a solo camping trip she took in the woods near a lake. It didn't turn out like she planned. She picked a spot where she'd hoped to be alone, but a surprising number of other people had picked nearby spots. And once she was there, she wasn't always sure how to spend her time. Here's a short reading.
If the forest were a room with a door, I'd probably be inside reading. But the open wood demands something else. A hike up the ridge, an hour with the chickadees, something like that. Solitude would appear to be defined by place as well as dependent upon it. What passes for being alone at home, say, wouldn't pass here. You don't pitch a tent to curl up with a novel.
Why not?
Well, I guess because my sense is that when you go outside, you should be experiencing the outdoors. And when you are reading a novel in particular, you're relying a lot on your interior life and you're living in your interior life. But on the other hand, I mean, that's my sense of what at least is expected. My instinct is always to get the novel out and start reading.
I think there's anything wrong with that.
No, maybe not. But I sort of, you know, there's this great tradition of, you know, going off into the woods and, you know, doing something. And I was trying to figure out, like, what is it I'm supposed to do here? Because, in fact, I really wanted to just, you know, crack the book and start reading. But then I thought, well, I could just be at home. I could be doing this at home. I should, you know, should the place I'm at, I should, you know, get something out of more than perhaps just the fact that I'm now separated from, you know, the place where I live.
One of your essays in your new book is about a couple who lived together as hermits for about 40 years. Did you relate to that when you met them? How did you find them?
I was at a meeting, a public meeting about land use in the Adirondacks, which is a big issue. And there was a man who got up to speak who looked unlike any other person in the room. Part of it was that his clothes seemed to have made in sort of circa 1930. And he just cut a very striking figure. And so when the meeting was over, I wanted to find out who he was. And I asked around and I was told he was a hermit, which seemed a little contradictory because we were at a public meeting. But I was told that he was a hermit who felt so strongly about this issue of development in a wilderness area that he decided to come out of the woods. So I went back to him and I explained that I was working on this book and I thought that he might have something to tell not only me but other people about the kind of life he lived. And he agreed, he and his wife agreed to let me come and spend some time with them. So I did, and they live in this really gorgeous spot on about 150 acres. And they were smart enough to build their house very, very far into the woods. And they cut a trail in, but it's very difficult to find unless you know what you're looking for. It has some markers. And I found their lives interesting and remarkable, and yet I understood pretty soon after I spent some time with them that it wasn't the life I would choose, but I thought they were admirable for doing it, although I think they wouldn't think of themselves as being admirable. They would think that they had no choice because they couldn't live in the material world that most of us find very, very congenial and comfortable.
I think there's two kind of standard ways of viewing hermits like that who've made the conscious decision to live alone in the woods. One is to take a kind of romantic view that it's you know, the life of solitude, a life of reflection. The other is to kind of place it square in the center of the crackpot tradition of American eccentricity.
Yeah.
In which did you find this fitting in? Some of both?
Both. They were very, very nice to me, and yet, because they didn't really have a lot to do with most people, their socialization and their sort of social skills were probably putting them closer into the more eccentric camp. But they had managed to construct a life that objectively is just so elegant that it's very hard not to romanticize it. And what I mean by that is that they had figured out, and without training, how to build a house, and not just how to build a shack, but how to build a beautiful house, and how to get hot water without having a hot water heater, and how to have tomatoes, really good, juicy red tomatoes in the middle of winter, and how not to go to the store. They had figured all these things out, and they did it in a very quiet way. They didn't do it, you know, by sort of reading a book, and they didn't do it by having to go to graduate school. They just figured out, they thought, you know, life is a process, and we're going to figure out our lives as a process, and they have.
In writing about solitude, one of the things you wanted to write about was solitary confinement. So you actually wrote to Robert Stark, who has been or was in solitary confinement at the Louisiana State Pen, and he had been on death row, but his sentence was changed to life. He was 34 years old. How did you come up with the idea of writing to him?
I wanted to write about solitary confinement in part because it's back to this idea of romanticism. It seemed to me that in talking about solitude, that I couldn't avoid looking at situations where it was not a romantic ideal, where solitude, in fact, was something fairly horrific. And I wanted to find someone that had spent a lot of time in solitary confinement, and I have a friend who's a nun who works with death row inmates in Louisiana, and I talked to her and asked her who I should be talking to, and she suggested this man, Stark, and so we started to correspond, and that correspondence lasted quite a while and was a fairly chastening experience for me because even though I had had this idea of a sort of a lack of romantic ideal about prison, I still started asking him questions that he found to be so naive and so stupid, and he pointed that out to me pretty early on.
What kinds of questions?
Well, I think that the key question was, I said, so what's the best thing about solitary confinement? Thinking, you know, maybe he would have some insight about it that, you know, I'm not sure what I was thinking he would say. And he said, you know, there isn't anything good about it, you know. And I realized that it was sort of my own fantasy or my own projection that, you know, one was going to be able to find some goodness in this hell. And, you know, he pointed out very, very clearly that wasn't true, and that if you're going to spend the rest of your life in jail and most of the rest of your life in solitary confinement, there is nothing good about it.
Stark, in one of his letters, in answer to your question, what's it like to be in isolation, wrote, it's like having hell all to yourself.
Yeah, it was that moment when I read that, and I thought, you know, that is as pure a description as I've ever read. Then it went on. I mean, I asked him to describe very succinctly the physical characteristics of the room that he was in, and he did that. And again, I mean, it was just, you know, reading language like his, which is very spare, is just can set chill, you know, send chills up your spine, you know, because it's not, you know, he was not a novelist. He's not writing, you know, hey, you know, my cell looks like this, it's like this, it's like this. He's saying, this is how I live my life. I live my life in a room that is essentially the size of a bed. I wear leg irons. I'm not allowed to wear underwear. I'm not allowed to read books. I cannot have a pen. I'm not allowed to talk to people. There's a light on 24 hours a day. That's not fiction. That's real. And when you're sitting in your house in the middle of the woods reading this, looking out the window at your beautiful mountain, and you read, you know, it's just horrifying.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sue Halpern. She's written a new collection of essays called Migrations to Solitude. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sue Halpern, author of the new book, Migrations to Solitude. Another place that you went to get a sense of what solitude is like was an abbey, a monastery in Kentucky, and this was the same monastery that Thomas Merton had been in. Why did you go there?
I wanted to go to a monastery for a couple reasons. One was I was really intrigued, and I thought I probably would never put myself in the position of being in a monastery and even going to a monastery as a visitor, as a tourist. But now I had the opportunity to go as a journalist and as a writer. That was part of it. I also wanted to go someplace where people lived in silence. I was really intrigued by this idea of silence and what it leads to. And I knew that by going to Gethsemane, which has a rule of silence, that I too would be bound by that rule for as long as I was there. I wanted to be able to feel that myself and to look at that and to observe it and then to relate it.
What conclusions did you reach?
When you live in silence, you tend to use language very sparingly when you use it at all. And as a consequence, language takes on a whole new meaning and it has a kind of added value. When you use language the way we do, which is as a form of, you know, daily communication, its currency is kind of inflated. I mean, people just talk. You know, words are cheap. And in a monastery, you use very few words, and so you choose your words pretty carefully when you do speak. And so to that end, for me, I came to really appreciate the value of language. And I think as a writer, that's also a wonderful thing to remember. So there was that. There was also this idea that here was a community of men that lived fairly close together, and yet they were able to live in that way, in a very harmonious way, in part because they were not speaking all the time. They were not speaking hardly at all. And it was a kind of social lubricant to be silent. And I noticed this with the people I was with on retreat. They were all strangers to me. I knew nothing about them. I wanted to know nothing about them. And yet I had very warm feelings towards them, I think in part because I wasn't distinguishing between one or the other. By being silent, I didn't know their views, say, on abortion. I didn't know their views on, you know, whether President Bush was a good president or not. I couldn't listen to their accents and get a sense of who they were from that. And as a consequence, I didn't make distinctions or judgments about them. I just thought, here are a bunch of people on retreat who are looking for something, whether it's for God or for some inner peace or whatever it is they're looking for. And that was my basis for knowing them. And it was a kind of equalizing basis because I didn't have any sense of them outside of that quest.
Well, I thought it was interesting that you started wondering if there wasn't perhaps something misanthropic about this sort of retreat, because it's easier to think kindly of strangers if you don't need to talk to them or if you don't need to listen to them.
I think, you know, and always with solitude, I think there is an edge to it, and it might be this misanthropic edge. For me, in that setting and in almost any other setting, the reason why that's useful is because it's temporary. I don't think that I could go on relating to people solely on the basis of, you know, of not knowing them. Because there is a sense, I suppose, in which, you know, ultimately you're not making any connections. I think what's so useful about solitude is that it allows us to hear ourselves think. It allows us to come up with an idea of who we are. It allows us to ask questions to ourselves about who we are, and then it gives us the space to answer them without other people coming along and saying, well, no, you can't be that way, or no, you can't do that. And it gives us a certain amount of freedom. And we take that with us when we go back to being with each other. And I think, in the end, what it is that solitude lets us live with each other. It lets us live in communities or in families. And I think it becomes misanthropic if it's simply an end in itself.
Well, Sue Halpern, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, so much.
Sue Halpern's new book, Migrations to Solitude, is published by Pantheon. This is Fresh Air. Let's get a preview of All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. A new government is settling in Afghanistan, apparently, although one rebel leader is still holding out and holding onto some buildings in Kabul. A journalist, Robert Kaplan, explains the notion of an expanding Turkic world, including parts of Afghanistan and the Muslim republics of the former Soviet Union. We'll ask a few personal questions about the pyramid of food, what's healthy, what's not, and who cares. Bob Mondello reviews a film about the tragedy of Chernobyl, and we'll look back on the career of the composer Olivier Messiaen, who's died in Paris at age 83.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last week, scientists broke the startling news that they discovered the origins of the universe, which they say confirms the Big Bang theory. To find out how life as we know it may end, commentator Maureen Corrigan recommends that you read The City of Quartz, a book about Los Angeles by Mike Davis, which has been newly reprinted in paperback.
LA's boosters like to call it the city of the future. Mike Davis is no booster, but he does believe that L.A. is a crystal ball in which we can glimpse shadows of what's in store for the rest of urban America. In City of Quartz, Davis writes about L.A. like some kind of La La Land Nostradamus. He tries to make predictions based on what he sees in L.A. to prepare other cities for the 21st century. But Davis's L.A. crystal ball just flashes over and over the same dire message for urban America. Repent, the end is near. City of Quartz is one of those overstuffed, brilliant books that are hard to categorize. It's mostly social history, with doses of literary criticism, gossip, and elegy tossed in. One reason Mike Davis's book is so eclectic is him. He doesn't boast your typical intellectual curriculum vitae. Davis worked for years as a meat cutter and truck driver before he went to college and eventually became a lecturer in urban theory. What's even more unusual about Davis is the fact that he's a native Californian. So when he writes about places like the abandoned socialist city of Llano del Rio, you feel like you're being taken on an insider tour while everybody else is heading for the La Brea tar pits. In the opening chapter of City of Quartz, Davis surveys the work of filmmakers and other writers who've portrayed L.A. as utopia and dystopia. People like Orson Welles, Nathaniel West, Raymond Chandler, and Joan Didion. He also cites those gloomy Gus expatriates, Aldous Huxley and Bertolt Brecht, to whom L.A. was a sunny boneyard of culture where people could rot without feeling it. Davis then moves into the present to consider the city's disintegrating economy and ecology. And in a truly scary chapter entitled Fortress L.A., he discusses the city's sadistic street environment. There are creepy black and white pictures here of inner city shopping malls built around police watchtowers and so-called bum-proof bus benches that make sleeping impossible and sitting tricky. Davis says that early urban visionaries like Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed New York Central Park, celebrated the democratic mixing of people. But contemporary architects in L.A. use reflective glass, ramparts, and elevated pedways to protect the middle class from exposure to the streets. He describes the hyperstructures that dot L.A. as the semiotics of class war. The most chilling aspect of Davis's apocalyptic view of L.A. is that he really means it. It's not just a clever trope. Along with his other odd identities, Davis is a Marxist. In fact, he begins his book with an epigram from Walter Benjamin, arguably the greatest Marxist critic of the 20th century. In his famous essay on another city, entitled Paris, Capital of the 19th Century, Benjamin talked about how the future arises out of the crumbling ruins of the past. This is your standard Marxist dialectical reading of history. But Davis concludes his book in a circus wrecking yard filled with broken-down rides and cracked stone elephants. It's a place he calls the junkyard of dreams. Those visions of the future that Davis saw out in the L.A. desert must have been so terrifying that he prefers to leave us in the ruins.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed The City of Quartz by Mike Davis. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Joan Tuohy and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Irish writer Shane Connaughton. He wrote the screenplay for the new film The Playboys, starring Aidan Quinn and Albert Finney, and he co-wrote the screenplay for My Left Foot. Also, we talk with architect Joe Spear, the principal designer of the Baltimore Orioles' new ballpark and other baseball and football stadiums. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
For election night coverage here on 91 FM. The forecast this evening, a chance of rain, maybe even a thunderstorm, partly cloudy.